but mostly we give thanks for each other. Join me, Chef John Folsom, Craig Haney, Livestock Manager at Stoneborn Center in New York, as we talk turkey on Starting It Up next. But first, the news.
Barbara Klein. Boeing is warning that engines on some of its new planes could run into icing problems. As NPR's Sam Sanders reports, the aircraft maker is urging 15 carriers to avoid flying them near high-altitude thunderstorms.
Boeing has issued a notice that prohibits affected aircraft at high altitudes from flying within 50 nautical miles of storms that may contain ice crystals. Since April, six planes powered by the GE Gen X engine temporarily lost thrust while flying when ice crystals ran through the engines. All the planes managed to land safely. A GE spokesman said the aviation industry is experiencing more icing situations as more commercial airliners travel in tropical regions of the world. Both Boeing and GE say they're working on a software fix for the engine control system to solve the problem. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
Delegates at UN climate talks in Poland reached a last-minute compromise today. This after discussions deadlocked when China and India argued that developing nations shouldn't have to commit to cutting the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions as developed countries. From Warsaw, the BBC's Matt McGraw reports it's one compromise among many aimed at a larger global deal in 2015.
After an hour-long huddle in the corner of the hall, a compromise was found, where the word contributions was substituted for commitments. It may seem like a trivial detail, but it allows the richer countries to continue to claim that a new deal will apply to all, while for India and China, it allows them to maintain that their obligations will be very different from the likes of the US and the European Union. This was a key moment of compromise, but many others will be required before the work is done in Warsaw. A new deal in Paris is still a very long way away.
That's the BBC's Matt McGraw in Warsaw. Venezuelans took to the streets today in a nationwide day of protest over the country's deepening economic crisis. John Otis has details from Caracas.
Venezuelans are fed up with food shortages and spiraling inflation. They're also angry about a new law that allows socialist President Nicolas Maduro to rule by decree on economic issues. Annual inflation is 54%. One protester, Luz Sanchez, ticked off a list of groceries she has a hard time finding.
From chicken to milk, sugar, coffee, toilet paper.
President Maduro blames speculators and has ordered stores to slash prices. But that may not be enough. Local elections are 2 weeks away and opposition candidates are expected to make big gains. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Caracas.
Negotiators for Iran and six world powers have been meeting for an unplanned fourth day in Geneva, trying to overcome differences on an agreement that would ease some sanctions against Tehran if Iran freezes its nuclear program. This is NPR. In Syria, seven Islamist rebel groups are forming a new alliance. It's expected to be the largest faction battling Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's regime. And it's the second major consolidation of Islamist authority among Syria's armed opposition groups. In September, several brigades withdrew from the Western-backed coalition to call for Sharia law in Syria. The Obama administration says a move by China could destabilize the status quo in the East China Sea. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Beijing, China has mapped out a new air defense zone in the region that includes islands Japan claims.
On its website, China's defense ministry says that establishing the new air defense zone will help China to monitor and react to possible threats and intrusions. It adds that creating the zone is just exercising its right to self-defense in a way that many other countries have done. The zone extends far off China's coast and ranges from areas west of Japan's main islands down to waters near Taiwan. The zone includes the disputed islands known as the Diaoyus in Chinese or the Senkakus in Japanese. The defense ministry says all planes in the zone must obey Beijing's orders, but that China will respect rights of overflight. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
New Mexico and most of Texas are getting slammed by winter-like weather. The National Weather Service has issued winter storm warnings in the southwest as freezing rain and snow are expected to fall throughout the weekend. The same powerful storm system also brought heavy rains and high winds to California, Nevada, and Arizona and has been linked to hundreds of accidents and at least four deaths. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities at kresge.org.
For the finest in classic ska, rocksteady, rockers, DJ, dancehall, and dub, it's Jamon. Cecil here, bringing you Southwest Louisiana's longest-running reggae tradition, Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m., or Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m., and streaming live anytime at krvs.org.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and thank you for joining us at the kitchen table for another hour of good chat between Michelle Yark and team here around the table. And I want to begin by welcoming Miss Yark.
What's going on today?
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm doing very well.
Anything you want to share with us before we get into the show? I mean, anything you want to come clean about this week?
I have a verbal exam today, so we got to chop chop.
So the big show comes second, John. Dean Slama across the glass wall over there, keeping our sound balance and, of course, music dynamic, picking all the good choices. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Chef. You always give me the best introduction. I appreciate that.
Well, I mean, you know, look, I believe just like Michelle, when I introduce, I like to make sure I put the accolades right on top.
Yes.
Isn't that nice, huh? Anyway, y'all, it's something else. And, you know, Michelle, just a few days to go before we set for the big feast. You know what I mean?
I know. I'm getting ready.
November.
I'm really looking forward to being with family, seeing friends. Yeah, I mean, you see them all year long, right? I mean, most people.
Well,
try not to,
but they sneak in every now and then, you know?
But we get focused on work and school and errands, and we don't fit people in as much as we should. But Thanksgiving gives you that chance to put it all into focus.
That's right. Pulls it all back together, y'all. That's very true. And because those around you make the day special, I mean, you want everything to be special for them as well. There's so much effort put into getting the recipe is right. The sweet potato pie can't be too soupy like the one my brother brought last year. I hate to say
it. Oh, no.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I don't normally have him over because of that pie he likes to bring every year. I mean, Michelle, I normally tell him we're out of town this year. But he snuck in with that soupy pie, and oh, my God, I tell you. Well, I guess it is time for family, you know. Not too much salt in the dressing like my sister did last year, you know.
Come on now. You keep going, you're going to be by yourself for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, the turkey needs to be a little moist and flavorful in my cousin. You know, she thought, she kept telling me about this family recipe from the 1890s, and it reminded me why it should have stayed back there when I tasted it. Anyway, I'm in a joyful mood today.
I see you're ready. You're ready for the holiday.
I'm just kidding. Anyway, no, it is the perfect time of year and the perfect time of year for a cook. cooks love this time of year because it gives you an opportunity to do the things that are tradition, the things that are family oriented, the things you want to share, the recipes you want to talk about. I mean, it's a great time of year for a cook.
I'm sorry. As you say that, I kind of reminisce. I'm thinking back to last Christmas, and I believe you said, I'm not cooking again.
Well, I say that every year. Everybody says that every year. Every family says that every year. I'm not cooking again. And then here we go. And of course, I look forward. You know the one I look really forward to every year? I love cooking for the nuns. I cook for Sister Dulce up in Baton Rouge. Oh my God, I love cooking for those nuns. Number one, all of those nuns are great cooks.
Yeah.
They're good cooks.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, like, oh, absolutely. They're great cooks. But I get a chance, and we have a tradition at Sister Dulce's. I bring the turkey, and she and I love turkey necks. Uh-huh. Oh, I love turkey necks. I'm going to tell you right now. And what I do, I get an extra pack of turkey necks, and I put them around this 20-pound turkey with all the seasonings, and those necks cooked in the seasoned liquid from the roasted turkey.
Oh, boy.
And the minute I get to the convent over there, and I lay all of this food out, here they come. And Sister comes with this gleaming eye. You know, you can see her coming, right?
She's
coming,
twinkle.
And she says, are you ready for our ritual? I said, I sure am. I give her a plate of turkey necks, and she's got this beautiful white habit on. And I said, Sister, you're going to get that grease on your habit. She said, I'm not worried about that. Give me a turkey neck. Anyway, I love cooking this time of year, and there's so many different methods of cooking everything, including the turkey. I'm sure there's one that you could awe anyone with. I'll bet you could even find one for all of you out there today. Get your notepad ready. You too, Dean. I have Cooking Turkey 101 for you. And you have to decide what size turkey you want to purchase, depending on the number of guests you'll be serving. You want to figure on about 2 pounds of meat per guest. That's what I always say. You know, so if you got 10 guests, 2 pounds of meat per guest. Because 1 pound for dinner and 1 pound for leftovers, 1 pound for the gumbo. You know what I mean? You need the turkey poulet sandwiches. I mean, you need 2 pounds per person. You know, that 8 ounces for today and that 8 ounces for the sandwich and that 8 ounce for the gumbo. And then I guess if you and your family's coming, then we might need a little bigger turkey. But
Well, I've got my Tupperware ready. I'm just saying, for extras. And
You never tell a real cook that you got Tupperware ready. I mean, you don't.
I know.
We can try to eat it all.
I very seldom had leftovers. So. My master Rang used to say at the Zarang house, even the dog will walk away from a turkey carcass because there's nothing left on it. Even the dog will walk away.
Oh, my gosh. No, you know, I like turkeys with extra legs.
Extra legs?
Yeah. I've heard that there are recipes where the chefs separate the legs from the turkey before they cook it, and then you have extra.
You mean those mutants? I never heard of a turkey with extra legs, but
I guess that's a traditional presentation. But
well, I got turkey with extra necks, so I guess this can. Anyway, y'all, some do that for roasting. They'll take the legs off. I like to tie my legs tight together to keep all the herbs and flavors on the inside of that carcass. I put carrots and garlic and onions and all that in there, dressing sometimes, and I'll close the legs shut. A lot of cooks and home cooks especially will take the legs off and put them in the side of the pan and let them roll separately because they figure that helps the breast meat cook a little faster because the legs aren't blocking that heat from getting into the end of the breast, which I guess makes a little sense. But the problem with that is that it just takes away from the presentation of the bird, and I love the presentation as well.
I know sometimes you do stuffing inside the bird, but you also said like onions and carrots and do you eat that then, or is it just strictly for
seasoning? Oh, my God, yeah. No, of course you eat it, huh? You put it off to the side. When I slice the turkey, right down the middle, I put all of the seasoning vegetables that's been cooked in the bird because they've absorbed all of that wonderful flavor. Oh, my God.
So that's just another side dish.
Another side dish, absolutely. A garnish for the center of the platter, right.
I can remember Mama and Mom, too, getting up at the crack of dawn to begin all the Thanksgiving preparation in the kitchen. And this was after spending a whole day or several days chopping and prepping and cleaning and getting everything ready. But the bird had to go in the oven with enough time to cook before everybody arrived and before everybody passed out from hunger. So, any tips on how to get a faster turkey?
Well, I think that was before.
I know you would never say cook it the day before.
No. A turkey should always sit a minimum of 2 hours before carving.
You are kidding!
A minimum of 2 hours before carving. because when you take a turkey out of the oven, you're going to have that steam of 212 on the inside of the bird. It's going to probably have cooked up to about 180 on the breast meat. And you eat meat at about 130 to 140, so it needs to cool down. The juices redistribute in the bird. So when I take my bird out of the oven, I always allow a minimum of 2 hours to just sit wrapped in that foil over to the side of the table and let all of those juices redistribute as the bird slowly cools down past that 180 to 140. And I say 180 because I put a digital thermometer in the breast, the heaviest breast meat of a 15, 16-pound bird, and I bring that temperature in the breast meat up to 180. And when I get it up to 180, I know that the meat in that dark meat of the legs and the thighs are juicy. I know that the breast meat is absorbing all of that wonderful liquid because I inject and I brine my birds as well, which I do have my recipe for that. All of those juices steam and cook inside of that bird. And of course, remember the turkey fryer too. I mean, I had been before. By the way, frying a turkey is not as perilous as the task once was. They make fryers now that sit on countertops of your kitchen island. They have those with the rotisserie basket, which I just got.
You got the fryer with it?
Well, it is an automatic turkey fryer that holds up to an 18-pound turkey, and it's a rotisserie fryer. So you put your 18-pound turkey on it, you press the button, and it just brings the temperature up. Then the rotisserie starts to turn, and it turns inside of the hot oil up and around. It's a beautiful piece of equipment. It's made by Waring, and I just got it in. The rotisserie and basket has the safety catches on it so it won't splash or spill oil. And the beauty of frying a turkey is that it cuts the cooking time in half, and you can cook about a 12-pound turkey in about 40, 45 minutes. And you're not only going to have the juiciest turkey you ever ate, but you're also going to have used only 1 tablespoon of oil into the meat of that turkey. A lot of people say, oh, I don't want all that oil and all this other kind of stuff. But, oh, no, absolutely. Only 1 tablespoon of oil will be used. Also, you're still able to season it to your liking since you're using a dry rub or spice mix underneath the skin and all of that. So a lot of great flavoring technique also to frying. But I still bake my turkey. I still roast my turkey, so to speak, and let it sit until the temperature hits 140 before slicing. Unbelievable. That's a 2-hour wait to carve the bird. Yeah.
You mentioned dry rubbing. That's kind of old school, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Salt, pepper, herbs. I mean, you know, everybody did dry seasonings, what we call top seasoning, seasonings under the skin with some herbs and seasoning, long before these turkey injection kits came out. I mean, nowadays, you know, companies came out like Cajun Injector and these companies that created beautiful injection flavor, which is absolutely fantastic. You're adding moisture to the bird in doing that. So I certainly recommend the injection process. You can buy the injector and the seasoning. I personally like the butter garlic flavor for injection. But brining is also one of my absolute favorite methods of all because I control the total flavor and I add about 10 to 12% liquid or juice to the bird in the brining process that guarantees me a well-flavored, internal flavored, as well as a juicy, juicy bird.
How long do you soak the bird?
I bathe mine 24 hours, a minimum of 12, but 24 hours. And what I do, I create a liquid. And when you put that turkey down into a brine, and I put it in one of these orange igloo coolers, that way I can put the turkey down in there. It kind of confines the turkey to that space.
Idea.
A lot of people say, put it in an ice chest or something. Now you have way too much liquid. Put all my brining material ice cold on top of it. I normally boil my water with the salt and pepper and herbs to kind of flavor the water, but then I chill it overnight. Then I put my turkey in my igloo cooler, pour all that 3 gallons of highly flavored liquid on top of it, and let it sit a minimum of 12 hours. I much prefer to put it in for a full 24 hours before taking it out. And then
what if you decided to do 36?
Then I'd put a little salt, but I would never do that. 36, then I'd have a cured. I'd have a piece of bacon.
That's what I'm asking.
But anyway, y'all, we're going to have a lot of good stuff on there, a lot of good things that we have to talk about. But Slama's over there giving me a break, go to commercial. So
he's telling you shut up?
Tell me to shut up. Anyway, y'all, hey, the turkey's about to go on, so don't you dare go anywhere. We have a great guest.
Oh, we have a great guest.
We're going to see y'all back in a minute.
Who excels in bacon turkey? So when I want turkey, I go to Albuquerque. I'm such a hungry man. They gotta cook it east.
Greetings. I'm Jake Abair.
And I'm Adam Chouard.
Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM, KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
I like giving, you like receiving. When we get together, it's oh so pleasing. Happy Thanksgiving to you. I want to thank you for all of this good, good cooking that you do.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. It's so nice to have all of you with us today, and obviously we're talking about the star of the Thanksgiving table. We're talking about the turkey.
We're talking turkey.
And today, I tell you, I was very excited when I heard that Craig was going to be a guest with us, because you know how much I love Stone Barns.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've said, you and I have spent a fair amount of time up there. I know I've been to Stone Barns about two or three times. And you know, some of the students of the Chef John Foles Culinary Institute intern over there.
That's an awesome intern.
Oh my God,
internship
it's a, for them. You know, at Blue Hill. And they've always been very generous to us, and I love what they do there. And you know a little bit about my vision over at White Oak Plantation.
You want to be Stone Barn?
I can't. I couldn't. Nobody could be Stone Barn except Stone Barn. but I tell you what, I can have like a little piece of
you can have a pig.
Because every time I take people in my pig pen on my heritage breed chickens, I can say, and I learned this when I was over at Stone Barn. So, isn't that nice, huh?
That's very nice.
Now, you introduce our guest.
Yes, indeed. My pleasure. Craig Haney is with us today, livestock manager with Stone Barn Center in Pocanico Hills, New York.
That's around Sleepy Hollow.
That's right. That's right.
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is.
In our mind, it is. After graduating from University of Michigan, Craig returned to Central New York to farm and teach at Farmers Museum in Cooperstown. He founded Skate Creek Farm, a pasture-based organic farm that raises poultry, veal, sheep, swine. He's been with Stone Barn since 2004, where he raises the turkeys and other animals, 23 acres of pasture land that he works with. He also devotes a great deal of time to teaching and to mentoring dozens of apprentices, interns, volunteers, who do want to know more about livestock and livestock management. Craig is one of four full-time farmers who work with the livestock at Stone Barns. About a third of the meat and poultry eggs that are produced is purchased by Blue Hill, the restaurant right there that you had mentioned. The remainder is sold directly to customers through farmers markets and the Stone Barns farm store. I wish we lived closer, you know. Craig, we know you must be, and pardon the cliche, but you must be running around like a turkey with your head cut off this time of year. Thank you for taking time to be with us on Stirring It Up.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
I can't believe we haven't met you. 2004, you've been there since 2004. I bet you we did see Craig.
We might have not formally met Craig, but we were at Stone Barn.
He was in our presence.
Well, it's quite an honor to be associated with Stone Barn Center and carry on the work that they do there. And for our audience who are such great foodies, and I know so many of them are familiar with Stone Barns, but for those who aren't, or those driving down I-10 across the South, can you share with the audience kind of the mission behind the center there?
Well, at our core, we're committed to improving the way America farms and eats. And those two are, you know, farming and eating are tied together. Eating really is an agricultural act and shapes our environment. So we're committed to raising awareness both with the public and school children. We have school kids here every school day of the year, as well as 8 weeks of summer camp.
Wow.
So we're committed to raising awareness in a way that we can change the way that people, you know, change for the better, improve the way that America farms and eats. And the farming part is, we also, a core part of our mission is training a new generation of farmers in what we like to think of as restorative, resilient agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Craig, you wear a lot of hats, as I understand. I mean, you step into a lot of roles. And I found this interesting because Mariette was telling me you and she had had a lot of exchange back and forth. And you apparently just recently taught a class on how to trim the feet of ewes, okay? I find that interesting. Now, that may be every day for you, but that just seemed a little different, and also a lesson on harvesting poultry.
Yeah. So those were actually for culinary students, too, which makes it even more interesting.
Tell us about that and those roles that you play.
Well, yeah, that's true. I feel like I do wear a lot of hats. Some fit better than others, obviously. I'm not I'd like to think that I was great at all of them, but the biggest hat that I wear is just being a livestock manager, which I like to think of myself more as an animal husband, which by itself sounds strange, but when you think about it being sort of resurrecting the old practices of animal husbandry, I really, that's the primary hat I wear. That takes, you know, a great majority of my time. We're trying to raise animals in such a way that they're able to express a lot more of their ancestral instincts, and doing that ends up requiring a lot more of a livestock farmer that chooses to do that. You invest a lot of yourself. So that's the biggest hat that I wear. Other hats, you know, farmers themselves wear a lot of different hats regardless of what type of farming a person might be doing. So whether it's repairman, equipment operator, for us, it's also marketing and distributing. Now, those are just a few of the other hats that a farmer would wear that I also need to put on. But then I'm blessed here because I'm able to put on other hats that you alluded to that a little bit already, just the teaching and the mentorship. And I'm really thankful to have that be hats that I do wear.
But I think it's interesting that you work with the culinary team. So what is that component? Is that something that you've always done? Is that something new? And
We've done bits and pieces. It's become a little more formal in the last, 8 months maybe. We've done two programs through the International Culinary Center. And the students come for a week and participate in various activities around the farm. You know, with me, we processed or harvested poultry and trimmed ewes' feet and checked their body condition scores. And it's really just getting back to the public awareness part. Chefs are very influential, as we know, in society, and it's about trying to train, or educate young chefs about issues that involve small-scale agriculture in a way that we can form relationships that will, again, improve the way America eats mm-hmm. farms.
Man, I love that. I love the aspect of educating the young culinarians.
Well, I think at my culinary school at Nicholls State University, I mean, we have a Bachelor of Science degree in culinary arts, so we have a 2-year degree and a 4-year degree. And Stone Barns has been very generous to us in internship programs there. But I think nothing is more important than what you do, Craig, as a teacher and a mentor to culinarians who will then not only learn proper methods, but at the same time, you instill in them a passion that they take with them through life that has been missing in the kitchen, I should say, probably since the maybe mid-50s to the early 2000s, where we've gotten much more away from the family farm and much more a lack of information, knowledge, or care of the farm fresh technique or the farm raised technique. Are you seeing a lot of that changing now, and are you seeing professional culinarians being a part of that change?
Yeah, I think in so many ways they're leading the charge, quite honestly. I do feel like chefs have a special place in society that have really, partly through the food, I mean, we all really enjoy, you know, I think we got, so what happened through those years is like the food got so it didn't taste so darn good. And I think chefs are sort of reacquainting us to good taste and flavors.
Right.
So through the food, but also those that, you know, then with that in society, I feel like they've become spokespeople. So through the food and through the stories, I think chefs do have a prominent role in seeing responsible, you know, good eating agriculture come back into existence.
Mm-hmm. On our first trip to Stone Barns, there are certain things that I remember, like you could smell the apples and there were bowls of apples everywhere. And there happened to be a lecture that day on turkeys. Do you remember that?
Right,
and on Thanksgiving.
Very well, sure. Mm-hmm.
So we were able to sit in on that. And it was interesting to learn about heritage turkeys, which you all actually farm there. So tell us, what is a heritage turkey and some of the characteristics?
An organization that I hold in high esteem called the Livestock Conservancy pretty much codified this, partly just to make sure that people that are doing it right are able to market it, and they deserve a lot of credit along with Slow Food for helping the resurgence in heritage turkeys. You have to eat them to save them, and they helped create the demand for them in a way that, to allow folks like myself to be able to raise them. So their definition that I like to follow is that a heritage turkey can naturally mate. They have a long, productive outdoor lifespan. The outdoor part's important. You know, you're looking at 4 to 7 years of a productive outdoor lifespan. And they're going to grow more slowly than what has become the more conventional turkey. You're looking at, well, I would say at a minimum probably 28 weeks and maybe a little more than that for it to reach a good harvestable weight. So those are the three primary characteristics. And that sort of, especially thinking about the slower growth rate and the longer productive outdoor lifespan, those are going to naturally correlate with historic breeds. So the heritage part, the name heritage, I mean, there's some cultural heritage that comes along with breeds that were around, say, prior to 1950, you know, before we started going off in a certain direction with our turkeys.
And what kinds of turkeys do you actually have there? I think you have two distinct kinds that you actually focus on. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We actually do raise the more conventional, what are called broad-breasted whites. We raise them in a very different manner, but the genetics are genetics that we're used to, you know, as a society having in the last 60, 70 years, the broad-breasted white. The heritage turkey, I've raised a bunch of different varieties over the year, breeds over the years, but I've gotten very fond of a breed called the Bourbon Red. So we're getting ready to harvest 300 Bourbon Reds here in 2 days.
Where do you sell all those? I mean, are orders coming in? Because I remember several years ago, I think we were put on the waiting list to try to get one of the heritage turkeys. So, I mean, there seems to be quite a demand, but how are you selling them?
We actually do all pre-orders, and it's that's one thing I don't need to really market, that they pretty much market themselves at this point. Both, I think, just because they're beautiful birds, and we have a lot of visitors coming to the farm. But actually, most of the people that buy our turkeys now have been buying a turkey from us for close to a decade.
Wow.
And we've really become part of the holiday tradition. So we do all these pre-orders, and to be quite honest, they sell out within just a few days, you know, as many as 300 of the Bourbon Reds, for example.
Wow.
Now, what about the processing? Do y'all do that on site? I remember hearing the technique when we were there last, where the birds were actually loaded up and then taken to a local processor that y'all kind of worked with and managed the idea of the processing themselves, not to stress out the bird, etc. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. We do process all the turkeys here on site ourselves. So the crew that's been responsible for raising them from the time they were just little day-old poults to when they're harvested, you know, the same crew is involved from start to finish. So it's an intense 2 days for us. We'll be harvesting actually tomorrow, Sunday, and Monday. It's intense in that, you know, the birds are big. It's quite a workout when you're, you know, say a Bourbon Red Tom will be maybe 25 pounds alive. So just all the handling of the weight, picking them up, you know, they go into a cone where the arteries are severed, and then go into what's called a scalding tank. It's about 142-degree water that will help loosen up the feathers after they've been officially killed, and then they go into a machine called a plucker, which will mechanically remove most of the feathers, not all. There's a lot of hand plucking as well, but the machine takes the majority of them off, and then they move into another room where we do the evisceration part, the removal of the entrails of the birds, and then they go into chill tanks. So there's a lot of handling from start to finish, and it takes a lot of ice.
Right, sure.
You know, we got to be very organized with, you know, you have between the reds and the whites, we'll have close to 600 turkeys.
Wow.
That we then need to put into our walk-in cooler and organize in a way, because when we do our pre-orders, they're all pre-ordered by certain weight ranges. We need to organize them all.
That's very labor-intensive and very hands-on, much more so, I think, than I realized.
Is this the only animals that y'all raising for production and sale like this, or do you have other meat as well?
No, we actually do quite a lot. We have about 8 different animals that we're responsible for. We do a fair amount of all of them. You know, for example, we have 23 hives of bees. We'll harvest about 250 pigs this year. We'll keep 9 to 12 sows around at any one time. We harvest about 80 lambs a year. We'll raise 6,000 meat chickens in a year. We keep 1,200 egg-laying chickens around year-round.
Wow.
We do a smattering of geese. We raise some geese, but it's kind of a learning satellite project for us at this point. And it has really mostly to do with the processing end of things. I'd love to raise a lot of geese, except that they're really hard to pluck, for example.
Right, right. Do y'all raise turkeys based on the number of orders you get, or are you kind of maxed out at a certain number that you can guarantee will be sold?
We're pretty much maxed out, and it's not so much for labor or, you know, we could reallocate resources, not to get too sidetracked on this, but our livestock management principles involve raising a number of different species in rotation on pastures. You know, we're raising a lot of animals on relatively limited pastures, so it's quite a choreographed dance. Sometimes we're stepping on toes, sometimes it's really elegant. It can range in both directions, but it is highly organized, the rotation. So we can't really tweak the animals too much in any one direction, the numbers of the different species that we have, without affecting everything else in the rotation. I could see us tweaking it a little bit, maybe a few more turkeys than we're raising now, but not very significant increase at all.
And now, just again, for our listeners, the cost, because I think people are kind of jaded in really what the cost is to manage the quality of a bird like this that eventually will end up on a table. What is the cost of, say, a 15-pound bird without the shipping? I mean, just per pound or whatever. How do y'all sell them?
For a heritage turkey, you're going to be looking at, that would be just a little more than $100. You know, and that can sound like a lot, but when you're talking about the heritage genetics,
sure.
The birds themselves, you know, even as young birds, we've kept some breeding stock of the turkeys around. We don't currently, but so when we buy the poults from a hatchery, the place that will hatch them out, and they'll be close to $10 before, you know, just as a day old, you know, weighs ounces.
Right.
And then you think about herding them. We actually herd our turkeys in and out morning and night. We herd them into a barn for safety's sake, just to protect them from predators. We actually, even though we're in suburban New York, we have a lot of coyotes in the area. So you think about all the labor that goes in, you know, over months, literally more than 6 months, there's a lot invested in raising a heritage breed and having it be delicious at the end.
Do y'all also, along with the turkey, give cooking instructions and the way to best prepare your bird versus something you would buy in a grocery store?
Thanksgiving comes with a lot of pressure for a lot of families, at least those that are making the meal. So we do like to give some guidance if they're looking for it. The interesting thing is we've noticed over the years, if the birds are real large, you know, we've had some concern that they, like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to have enough time to cook it, for example. But our birds, there's something about the density of them. They're more dense than what you would buy in the grocery store. And to be quite honest, I've researched it. I'm not entirely sure what it is. I don't know if it's water, extra water weight grocery store birds have that might insulate and make it take longer to cook. But our big birds will cook generally a little more quickly than one would expect otherwise.
Craig, in the last minute we have here, would you tell everyone exactly where you located in New York for all of those going to the city for the holidays or whatever that might want to come out to visit?
We're in suburban New York, and we're actually pretty conveniently located just north of the city where there's the Metro North rail line. You know, you can get it at Grand Central, take it right up to the Tarrytown train station, and we're just a 10-minute cab ride from the train station, actually. It's Tarrytown, Sleepy Hollow are our closest towns, and that's where the train station is. And
Well, I can tell everyone, we've been there quite a few times. It is the most beautiful drive out of New York City. Mm-hmm. It's not that long to get there. Once you get there, you step back in time into one of the most beautiful spaces you've ever seen. And the tour, the conversation, the facility is one of a kind. The Blue Hill restaurant there is incredible. You want to make reservations in advance, obviously. And when you get there, I want you to give Craig a hug and tell him we sent you. That's the main thing we want you to do. So, Craig, happy holidays to you. Happy Thanksgiving. And thanks for being with us on the show. And I promise you, we're going to get to see you this year. We'll walk the flocks with you before next Thanksgiving, okay? And if you're on your way to New Orleans, please come to see us at our White Oak Plantation property. I have an antebellum plantation property in Baton Rouge that we're also doing a small little piece of what you're doing, just to remind my culinarians and everyone else about the importance of understanding what it takes to carefully raise and nurture an animal. And y'all have been a great inspiration for me personally on that, so I thank y'all for that. So happy Thanksgiving to you, okay?
Yeah, thank you very much. Happy Thanksgiving for you both as well.
And y'all, don't you dare go anywhere. We'll be back in just a minute with a great recipe.
Otherwise, I know I'll catch it when the lady with the hatchet makes a chop, chop, chopping sound. She sells us deer each and every year, dead turkey.
salsa, merengue, cumbia. The great Latin dance genres never die. Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. Join me for a tour of the best new dance music from all over Latin America. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi everyone, this is Pat Mitchell-Worley, and coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we'll hear a show that's near and dear to our heart, a tribute to Sid Selvidge, Bill Street Caravan's longtime executive producer and founder, who passed away this past May. It's going to be a fabulous show, so please join me and Kevin Cubbins next time for The Sounds of Memphis on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and on the web at krvs.org. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Gobble, gobble, strut, strut, shake your feathers, shake your butt. Turkey time's here today, so celebrate in every way. Yeah, I was born right.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And you know that because you listen to us each week. And before I get to the recipe, Dean, what about our Facebook page?
This is our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/stirringitupradio. So, of course, if you like the show, you should go out there because we do have about 800 friends these days. They're posting their pictures, getting their recipes up there, and, you know, we're posting pictures. So
next week, Michelle, I'm going to have my Israel Thibodeau melatons up. And I tell you what else I'm going to have. You know, I just did a 200-pound filled smokehouse of my own doing with my new recipe and my new, you saw my new sausage stuffer?
No.
Oh, you did?
No.
Slama, you know when people have a baby at the hospital, they go around showing all these pictures.
Uh-huh.
And then I loaded up my sausage stuff, and I took it to the mall to get those family pictures. You know, you get all these different. Me with
you
my stuff.
You got a
packet? Yeah, me with my stuff. I got a packet. I can get a 13-piece, you know, mm-hmm. little wallet sizes.
Am I going to get a wallet size?
Well, I don't want to ruin your Christmas present.
A photo of John and his sausage stuffer.
11 by 14. Huh? And it's already being framed, huh?
Oh, good.
Oh, that's absolutely. Nice. I'll nice. Tell you what, I expect to see it right there next to the Blessed Mother.
Huh? I'm sure you do.
Anyway, no, Facebook, y'all, you make sure you go there because that's where we tell a lot of our secrets, right?
Yeah, that's where all the secrets are, well, some of them.
What about books on the subject?
Well, the first one I'd like to recommend today, Thanksgiving Day. What is Thanksgiving? It was written by Polly Ann Lewis. It's
right.
a Kindle book. We're seeing more and more of those. Even though I'm a traditionalist, I still like paper and to be able to hold that book in my hand. But it's worth mentioning. The author gives the history behind Thanksgiving, what was on the menu, and a lot more information just about our American holiday and kind of how it's being celebrated around the world. You'll find methods for preparing the turkey with or without a stuffing mix, side dishes. Great book. Combines history and food, which of course we love. The next book I think you'll like, Thanksgiving 101. Dean, I think this one's for us.
Okay.
Celebrate America's favorite holiday with America's Thanksgiving expert, Rick Rogers. We were talking Turkey 101 earlier in the show, and so this book kind of finishes it up for us. The author teaches Thanksgiving cooking classes, has helped many first-timers and anxious hosts and hostesses to master the biggest feast of the year. Talks about how to plan ahead, how to divide and conquer, how to coordinate labor. I mean,
wow, he does it all.
He does it all because, really, that's a great part of it, right? Once you read his book with recipes for 10 different roasted turkeys and everything from appetizers to dessert, you'll have the confidence to pull off your Thanksgiving dinner and invite all your friends and family, as many people as you want. So these are both two good books for your library. We'll have that information on our website, jfolse.com. And wishing you luck with your turkey. We've given you some resources there. We used to have that Butterball hotline for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we didn't answer it.
But, you know, if you had turkey questions, I always thought that was kind of cool.
Well, Michelle, I think
what I found it.
What you found.
If you Google Butterball hotline, you can do a chat. You can email. You can instant message. Turkey talk line. They have the hours posted. This is interesting. They have the hours posted 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Thanksgiving Day, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. So even on Thanksgiving Day, you can get some help.
Get a last minute
advice.
Well, look, if you need advice on Thanksgiving Day, I tell you what, there's a restaurant around the corner for you to have. You know, by Thanksgiving Day, if you don't have all your questions answered, I'm going to tell you right now.
Yeah, 7 p.m. might be too late.
Anyway, y'all, I want to point out that on my website, jfalls.com, and also on our facts and figures pages, I think you call it. Is that what you call it, Michelle?
Guess
and goodies page. I'm going to give you a couple of recipes for some dishes that are favorites of mine, but I want to make sure that Michelle, that Mariette loads up my recipe for the crawfish stuffed wild turkey, because there's a lot of turkey hunters around the country that have these beautiful birds, but they don't know what to do with them, and they think that you cannot cook a great wild turkey, that they're a little tough or stringy. I have a recipe for wild turkey that's stuffed. You don't have to stuff it, but it's absolutely fantastic. But today, I'd like to share with you my recipe for roasting the turkey I'll do at home, including my brine, because I always brine a turkey. Is that good with y'all? That's good for you. Okay, well, brining is a pre-treatment in which the turkey is placed in a salt water solution known as a brine. This produces a moist and well-seasoned bird. Naturally, a turkey or meat in general will lose about 30%. That's an incredible number. But 30% of its weight during cooking. But if you brine the meat first, 24 hours or so, you can reduce the moisture loss by about 15%. So about half, you'll retain about half of that moisture, which is incredible. Additionally, brining enhances not only the juiciness, but the muscle fibers of the meat or the bird absorb the flavoring liquid during the brining period. And some of this liquid will get lost during cooking, but since the meat is, in a sense, more juicy at the start of cooking, it ends up much juicier and flavorful. And, of course, your brines have a lot of different flavoring ingredients in it, like sugar and honey, and which I'll give you in a minute, as well as herbs and spices. I always recommend brining a turkey in one of those orange igloo coolers, because you can put the bird neck down in the cooler. And, of course, once you pour the cold brine into it, you put the lid on top of it and you put it in, if you have a refrigerator big enough to put that cooler in, by taking out one or two of the bottom shelves, that's fine. But if not, the igloo cooler will keep the brine in the turkey cold outside, non-refrigerated, because normally it's cool enough this time of year, whether in the south, certainly the north, to be able to leave your igloo cooler outside or inside in a cool place, and it'll stay cold enough to brine that turkey for 24 hours, and that water will still be within the safety range inside that cooler. That's why I like to brine it in the cooler as well. You can also use an ice chest, but the only problem with ice chests is that it takes so much liquid that a lot of times I like to freeze 5 or 6 packs in one of these Ziploc bags of water and put those inside the ice chest with the brine. That way the water, as it defrosts, stays inside the bag and doesn't dilute the brine, but keeps the brine cold. You with me?
You
look at it a little bit.
No, I think.
Isn't that a good tip?
No, that's a very good tip, because you want to submerge the whole bird too, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Breast side down, or if in an igloo cooler, neck side in first. Begin brining one day prior to cooking. Naturally, I use the 24-hour method. method. Use a fresh bird, but look, check the label to ensure that the bird has not been pre-injected. A lot of your birds already injected, you know.
With seasoning?
Well, with flavors and liquids and salted waters, etc. So you just want to make sure, like a Butterball brand you mentioned. The reason it's Butterball is because it's pre-seasoned and injected with liquid. So you want to make sure that you're getting a non-injected bird. So what I do in a large stock pot, I dissolve 1 cup of kosher salt. If you don't have kosher, which is a thick kernel, you use 2 cups of table ground salt in 2 gallons of water. I add the brown sugar, so I have 2 gallons of cold water. I have a cup of kosher salt. I have 1/2 cup brown sugar. I have 1/4 cup of honey. I have 4 bay leaves crushed.
Hmm.
1 tablespoon of dried thyme. 1 tablespoon of dried basil. 1 tablespoon of dried sage. Remember, all dried. 3 tablespoons of granulated garlic. 3 tablespoons of black pepper. Now, that's your base. You can actually add whatever you like to it. If you want to add a whole bunch of basil, if you want to add fresh leaves, if you want to add some carrots, if you want to add onions, whatever you want, you can add to that base. Now, I would take my 2 gallons of water, stir all of these flavorings. I'd stir the salt and the sugar and the honey and the, all the thyme and basil, garlic, pepper. And then I would put it on the top of the stove, and I'd heat it thoroughly to make sure everything is dissolved. And I like to do that a day ahead of time. Plus, the water will be infused with all of this flavor by the time you pour this cold brine on top of the turkey.
You don't want to put the bird
No, of course not. Not in the hot water. So I would definitely recommend that you do your brine a day ahead of time and then take the pot and put it in the refrigerator or bag it or whatever. It's only 2 gallons. And that way the mixture will be ice cold. Then take the turkey, like I say, in the igloo cooler, put it the head side, neck side down with the legs sticking up, the cavity up, and then you pour that cold 2 quarts of brine with all of those seasonings. And like I say, if you want to add other things to it, you can at this point. And then you pour it in, cover the lid, and allow that bird to sit in there for 24 hours. So that's what I do. And you can cut the thyme in half if you want to by doubling all of the ingredients except the water.
Really?
If you want to brine it in 12 hours, just double all of the ingredients except the water. That way the water will be twice as flavored. You with me?
Okay.
And then to roast the bird. You ready to roast that bird? Huh?
Yeah.
I didn't know if you wanted to roast
stuffing
the bird.
Stuffing or dressing?
Well, either way, that stuffing, I'd have to give you another recipe. But okay, y'all. So I go ahead and the next day I take my bird out of the water, out of that nice pre-seasoning. Then I go into a roasting pan after I kind of dry it out. I don't rinse it or anything. I leave all that, you know, I just kind of leave all that dried thyme and everything that's still stuck to it or whatever. I just take, you know.
Don't rinse the bird?
No, indeed not. It's all full flavor. Why would I do that? I'm going to place it in a roasting pan on its back. And, of course, I'm going to, again, season it generously inside and out with salt, pepper, and granulated garlic. Don't worry about the fact that it's already pre-seasoned. That seasoning is now inside of the bird. So you want to season the outside with salt, pepper, granulated garlic. Extra seasoning should be placed inside of the cavity because you want to remember that that's a bony structure and that seasoning will not permeate the bird, but it will flavor the juices that go into the pan that you're going to make your turkey gravy out of, right? You want to remember that. Okay. I also run my hand under the breast skin. I make sure I don't tear it on each side. And under that, I like to put a nice blend of butter and garlic. And I make a little garlic butter by taking 1/4 pound of butter softened, and I add 2 tablespoons of minced garlic. And I either chop my basil leaves or I can put them in whole. I take the softened garlic butter and spread it under the skin on the breast meat. You got me? I just take a clump of it and I run my hand under there and I spread that butter. And I found it easier just to chop the basil and put it in with that garlic butter. A lot of times if I'm doing a photo session or something, I'll just put my hand under there after the butter's in and I put 2 whole basil leaves on each side or sage leaves. And that way they show through the skin when the bird is done. Either way is fine with me. I stuff the cavity with 2 onions that's been quartered, about 2 or 3 carrots. I put 2 halves of oranges in there, a little whole garlic. And then, of course, I put some of those same seasonings around the outer side of the bird in the liquid. I will go ahead and cover. Now, I want you to hear this after I tie the legs together, because the inside of that cavity has onions and garlic and all that in it. I tie the legs together, unlike what you mentioned a while ago, cutting the legs off, I tie them. I cover the pan tightly with aluminum foil. Now, I spray the inside of the foil with that vegetable spray to keep it from sticking to the skin of the breast.
That's a good idea, too. You're just full of good ideas
today, a lot of times the foil will burn on the skin of the bird. When you rip it off, you'll tear the skin. Who wants that at the table? I'd do like the great French Chef Vatel in the 1700s. I'd kill myself in the kitchen. But anyway, after the bird is fully seasoned, I spray the inside of the foil with vegetable spray. I even hit the top of the turkey with it. Then I'll cover it with foil. I try to make sure my foil is off of the breast, a little bit. Cover it tightly, y'all. This is the most important thing, because that keeps the steam inside of the pan. Cover it very tightly with foil. You cook it 3.5 hours at 350 degrees or until the internal temperature of the breast with a digital thermometer reads 175. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Then I'll rip the foil off and leave the turkey in the oven another 30 to 40 minutes until it is totally beautifully browned and the internal temperature of the breast has moved up to 180. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Now your turkey is beautifully browned, and I'd buy an extra pack of turkey necks for the bottom, in case sister shows up. I take the bird out of the oven then. I leave the digital thermometer in the breast, which is reading 180 now. I cover the pan again tightly with foil, and I just let that temperature come on down to 140 prior to slicing. By that time, 2.5 hours has gone by. Guests are arriving. I can rip that foil off, and everybody goes, ooh, and I.
So this begs the question, if that turkey has permeated the whole house, is sitting there for 2.5 hours, what are you serving?
What am I serving? What?
People are waiting to eat.
Well, my bird comes out of the oven 2 hours before lunch is served. So when they arrive, because there's a rule in my house. Number one, I do not allow anyone to bring anything into my house like a covered dish that so many of you American families love.
No.
When you come to
eat
a turkey.
That's because he doesn't like what anybody cooks.
No, it's not it. When I invite people to my home, I'm inviting them to my home. If I want their dressing, I'll go to their house. You with me?
You sure that's the reason?
That is the reason. Plus, my dinner is well planned. For you to walk in with that pan of my mare's fudge that you want to bring over, I already have dessert, so now you've messed up my table configuration. You want to feel guilty and bring out, like my brother, that sloppy pie he brings. He is not welcome back in.
Oh, no. The door's closed.
Oh, door's locked, absolutely. When I see that old white truck pull up, I said, lock the door, get the gun. I mean, keep him out of here.
Take your sweet potato pie at the door.
If he's got anything in his hand, shoot it out. Of course, I'm harassing. I'm just kidding. Anyway, y'all, I love the family. And yes, you can't bring anything you want with you to my house for Thanksgiving. You'll just be taking it back with you. Y'all, happy Thanksgiving. We're going to see you next week.
Once upon a time, Celtic musicians in the United States and Canada had to tread quite carefully for fear of incurring the wrath of that mysterious force, the folk police. These days, traditional music is strong and no one's getting dragged off to jail for experimenting a bit with an old world, new world blend. Do you want to hear it? Join me for the Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
This week on La Bellonera, tune in for an hour of Latin orchestras, from the Cuban Puerto Rican big bands of New York to the Tejano orchestras of South Texas, only here on KRVS 88.7 FM. Remember, Thursday at 11 p.m. on KRVS.
Hi, this is Brett Denon, inviting you to visit E-Town this week. I'll be joined by Nick and Helen, Sarah Cahoon, and the winner of the E-Achievement Award. That's this week in E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
Regional Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS-FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Le rendez-vous des Cadiens du Théâtre Liberté à Unis est rendu possible en partie par Le Best Stop Supermarket de Scott.
Underwriting for Rendezvous des Cajuns live from the Liberty Theater in Eunice